Hey, this is Ari. Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. I have an exciting show for you today, all about peptides, especially anti-aging peptides, a special class of them called bioregulators. This podcast is with Natalie Nidham, who is a holistic nutritionist, a human potential coach, and epigenetic coach who is immersed in the world of health optimization and longevity. A few years ago, she stumbled upon peptides at a health optimization conference and has been immersed in the study of these as health optimization and longevity tools ever since. And I have to say, on a personal note, she is one of the most well-versed people on this topic that I have encountered anywhere. She's really, really gone deep into the study of this particular area of peptides and specifically bioregulator peptides. Maybe deeper than all but a handful of people on the planet. Natalie runs a large and growing biohacking community on Facebook, the Optimizing Superhuman Performance Group, and is the host of the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Podcast. So with all of that said, I hope you enjoy this episode. You're going to learn about something you've probably never heard about anywhere else, and a very exciting rapidly growing field of research that has a lot of potential, anti-aging and longevity potential in particular, which is these bioregulator peptides. So enjoy the episode, and I hope you get a lot of value from it. So welcome to the show, Natalie. Such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Ari. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
I've heard lots about you, so it's very exciting to be here. Thank you for having me.
Likewise. I kept hearing your name from a lot of my friends, our mutual friends. And I, at some point, maybe 6 months or 9 months ago, started checking out your podcast. And I listened to a whole bunch of episodes with experts that you were interviewing on peptides, as well as some of your solo episodes. And I was very, very impressed with your knowledge. So I immediately said, this is somebody who I would like to have on my podcast to do yet another, maybe the fifth or sixth episode I've done on peptides, because I think you have a unique perspective on them, a lot of knowledge, a lot of depth and insight into this. And I think you bring a really nice woman's perspective to the whole mix as well. So I'm excited to get into this with you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's I spend a lot of time. I really started the podcast, my own podcast, with a view to learning more about peptides. And I thought, well, how am I going to get all these people to talk to me? And I thought, I know, I'll create a podcast. And lo and behold, I mean, not only did it, you know, it brought a lot of people, it would allowed me to speak to a lot of experts, but there's so much need for information and knowledge and not a lot of formal information around.
Yeah.
And so I think that the people who hold the biggest base of knowledge are the clinicians that are working with peptides right now. Mm-hmm. Not that there's not a lot of research going on, but there is, but it's one of those things that's being learned about a lot in real time. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to keep your fingers in the pies and, you know, keep tabs on what's going on.
Totally. And I love what you said about, you know, just figuring out, like, for your own personal interest in the topic and wanting to learn more, how do I get these people to talk to me? Well, let's start a podcast. You know, I think having been in this space a long time myself, I know a lot of different kinds of people who are among our colleagues, among people who have businesses in the online health space. And I think generally speaking, there are two, well, maybe three categories of people, if you include charlatans and psychopaths. But the two main categories of people are, I think, business people who happen to be in the health space.
Yeah.
And true health geeks who are just doing it because, you know, they'd be doing it even if they weren't making any money from it.
And, exactly.
You know, and that's, for me, I've been doing health science. You know, this has been my obsession since I was 12 years old. I did it for a long time before I ever made a dime from it. And
yeah,
it's what I'd be doing in my spare time, even if I had a job doing something else. So I'm blessed, I think, like you, to make my primary passion in life into a formal business that I can learn for my own selfish interests and teach and have fun and help a lot of people in the process.
Absolutely. And the sharing is amazing, right? So, and then I think we're not going to bore your listeners with too much of this little love fest, but I think the other big piece of it is connecting with other like-minded people, right? We are really blessed to be part of a community of people that is rather very exceptional and very varied. So
agreed. And if I can say so myself, I think the people who are the true health geeks do the best work. So
All right.
Kudos to you on that.
And you. Mutual pats on the back. All right, yes. Let's get into it.
All right. So peptides, first of all, what are they? Just for people who might be new to this, who maybe missed the previous peptide podcasts that I've done.
Yeah. So peptides really is another name for protein, right? But peptides specifically speaks to small proteins. So generally speaking, and it a little bit depends on who you speak to. I've heard that some people will define a peptide with as many as 100 amino acids long. So an amino acid is the building block of a peptide. So they're like the single block Legos. If you've ever played with Legos as a kid, or if you have kids who play with Legos, it's those little single blocks. So amino acids, there's 9 essential amino acids. There's a whole bunch of other ones that we can make in our body. But a peptide, by definition, is a short protein. So it's either 100 or more commonly 50 amino acids long. And those chains of amino acids are folded in very specific configurations in the human body, which exposes different binding sites that then bind to receptors and initiate different responses, you know, or initiate cascades in the body. We'll also today, you know, as pre-agreed upon, we'll also be talking about bioregulator peptides, which are a subset of peptides, and they are only 2 to 4 amino acids long. So these are the most teeny tiny little proteins you can imagine. They're not folded because they're too small to fold, but they're arranged in different sort of 3D configurations, which has an effect on their charge and how they bind to different things.
Okay. So, you know, later in this podcast, we're going to be talking about, you know, how do you administer these things? And, you know, in some cases you need to inject them. That's going to immediately scare off some people. And
for sure,
it's also going to trigger, you know, kind of a feeling of like, how does this differ from other kinds of injections and drugs and things like that? So maybe you can distinguish sort of the category of peptides from medications, pharmacological interventions.
That's a really interesting point. So when we talk, first of all, when we talk about injecting peptides, typically we're talking about a subcutaneous injection. So that means that it's being administered under the skin, usually into the fat layer. Even people who don't have a lot of fat have a little bit of fat there. It's a little bit like an insulin injection, right? So a diabetic will administer just under the skin a small injection of insulin to help control their blood sugar. I would say that, you know, peptides are, when you say distinguish them from medications, what's interesting about peptides is, I'm trying to think, but I think any peptide that we know of right now is based on a naturally occurring protein in the body. What it is very often is it's a fragment of that protein. So it's almost like you have a big structure, and within that structure, there's all these different functional elements. And it's almost like we've isolated a functional element, we've removed it from the main structure, we reintroduce it to the body so that we're trying to really tap into a specific effect, right? The other, you know, interesting thing about peptides, and it doesn't give them a buy necessarily, but a lot of people say, oh, well, they're very short acting. The body recognizes it can break them down. So typically, and I'm trying to think of all the peptides that I know of. And I mean, I'm not a pharmacist, so I don't have that big database, if you will, that a pharmacological person might have, but for the most part, they don't stick around for very long. Right. And generally speaking, what they're doing is, rather than suppressing something, they're initiating, they're getting your body to do something that it would normally do. But go ahead.
And our body has thousands, as I understand it, of peptides that are naturally produced and circulating in the body. And
7,000
are already there performing physiological roles, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Like, I mean, I believe there's 7,000 peptides we know of in the human body. We've isolated and people are working with a handful of them. But I would also say, you know, for most of the peptides that we will talk about and that people have been playing with, and I'm using the word playing loosely, these are not FDA approved compounds for the most part. A couple are the ones that are FDA approved. One of them in particular has been given orphan drug status in the US, but it's approved as a drug in about 30 countries worldwide. But for whatever reason, it's very hard to get your hands on in the countries where we live in. And without getting into any kind of politics or anything, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to understand why that might be, but it's a bit of a wild, wild west in many different ways.
Okay. So would you say, as maybe an analogy to understand kind of this distinction, like this is sort of the equivalent of supplementing with CoQ10 or creatine, you know, compounds that are that are naturally produced in the body as compared with a synthetic compound that was designed in a lab that's not natural, that interrupts physiological processes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, in that sense, yes. But, you know, most of the peptides and, you know, lately I've gotten into the habit of calling them alphabet soup peptides, which is really not a very technical term, but it's because the nomenclature is so miserable, right? You've got thymosin alpha 1, thymosin beta 4, BPC-157. You start throwing these things at people and their eyes kind of glaze over and they're like, what are you talking about? But definitely, what you said there is definitely yes. You know, the peptide, it's although it's synthesized in a lab, right? It is synthesized, but it's synthesized to be pretty much identical to what your body produces.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So that's kind of what I was getting at. I want people to be less scared of these compounds, knowing that your body already has thousands of these peptides that it's already right. using to perform various physiological functions.
For sure. But it doesn't mean that things can't go sideways.
Right.
Right. So it doesn't mean that, like, for example, I'll give you, like, for me, for example, I'm like, you know, a delicate flower in some ways. I'm super tough in many ways. But in other ways, I have an immune system that is sometimes pretty picky. Right. So I can't touch any of the growth hormone secretagogues. Growth hormone secretagogues. Lots of big words there. So growth hormone, we know that we all produce growth hormone. We need it to grow and to repair and to recover. Secretagogues means, the word secretagogue means it's going to make something secrete, right? So there's a class of peptides that will induce the body to produce and to release growth hormone, which is really cool because as we age, very often our growth hormone production declines. To the point where it gets in the way of us recovering from our workouts or healing from injuries and whatnot. And so these compounds, when they're reintroduced into the body, will get the signaling in the brain to produce and release growth hormone. So very cool because it's great for sleep, it's great for repair, it's great for recovery. Myself and actually many other people, we use them for a little while and everything's really great and our sleep scores are phenomenal and we wake up in the morning feeling great, may get a little bit leaner, we're recovering from our workouts better, like your skin starts to look really good, and then you look down and you go, wow, I mean, I guess I must have a mosquito or a spider in my bed because there's this bite and it's super itchy. And after a period of time you realize that A, the bites are getting bigger, and B, they're shockingly lined up with the last place that you administered a growth hormone secretagogue. Yeah. And it's your immune system saying, yeah, no, we don't like that.
Right.
So sometimes it can happen with certain peptides and certain people where their immune system develops antibodies to it and it becomes a no-go. Mm-hmm. The other thing to know about peptides is as much as they are native and the body recognizes them, is they're incredibly powerful. So there's a peptide called oxytocin, which many people are familiar with as a feel good kind of, you know, a bonding sort of hormone. It can be used in high doses to induce labor in women, but also in smaller doses, it can be used as an anabolic compound post-workout. And so it's pretty neat, right? I mean, it's not Nobody's turning into Arnold Schwarzenegger from this. I'm just putting it out there. Okay. So, I mean, I heard about this and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So I ran out and I got my oxytocin.
I haven't heard of this. I haven't heard of the oxytocin having anabolic effects. This is new to me.
So it can help. It can help with bone density and lean mass. And what you do is one might consider using it right after a workout. So oxytocin is interesting because you can either administer it subcutaneously, as we talked about, or you can use it intranasally. People will sometimes use it. People who are very shy, for some people, they find that if they use it intranasally before a social gathering, it helps them to relax a little bit. Doesn't do that for everyone. But the point of this story is that is to illustrate just how powerful these compounds are. So we're talking about 70, like in my case, 70 micrograms. So we're talking less than a tenth of a milliliter that is administered into the belly area. Within about 30 seconds, you have a head rush. You're like, you feel like this pressure in your head, your ears start to get hot, your face starts to get hot. Like, how crazy is it that the teensiest little drop of this substance introduced into the fat in your belly inside of a minute can produce a systemic effect like that? And to me, I often will tell this story because I believe that, you know, a lot of biohackers are out there saying, oh, I heard about this peptide. I'm going to use this now. And I'm going to use this now. And I'm like, you know what? You got to have a little respect for these things because they're powerful. They're tiny and they're mighty. And we know, you know, we're learning more about them all the time. And we only get one body. So go slow and, you know, do your homework.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Okay. So we've got this whole category of peptides. We've got thousands of them in our body. And we now have access to man-made peptides that in many cases mimic the ones that are naturally occurring that we can use to amplify certain physiological mechanisms or functions. And to name some of those, you mentioned growth hormone, you mentioned oxytocin, there's BPC-157 and TB4 for speeding up tissue healing. There's some brain peptides. There's a number of others. One of the most interesting categories that I want to talk to you about is bioregulators. Mm-hmm. And this is something that there's this weird thing where every time I try to look and find evidence for them, there's very little to find, like on some of the available search engines. But then there seems to be also books written on the subject and people referencing, you know, hundreds of studies that have been done on these, I think mostly out of Russia. So tell me about bioregulators and what that category is all about and what it's designed to do in the body.
Yeah. So bioregulators, I think are going to, they're catching the attention of a lot of people. And frankly, they've been being studied, as you say, in Russia for the last 40 years, right? So they're not new. They're nothing new, except they're new to us. And so, as we said earlier, they are the tiniest of the peptides. They're only 2 to 4 amino acids long, and that gives them privileges, right? And one of the books actually that you're referring to refers to bioregulators as epigenetic switches. And that's exactly what they are. They are an epigenetic switch by definition is something from that affects the expression of your DNA. And a bioregulator peptide, when it's introduced into the body, will make its way, it'll cross the cellular membrane, it'll cross the nuclear membrane into your nucleus, which is where your DNA lives. It'll bind to the DNA and it'll upregulate the expression of different proteins and whatnot.
Okay, so distinguish that from non-bioregulator peptides.
So the other peptides, I mean, some of them do influence genes, but for generally speaking, they bind to receptors. They're not necessarily honing in on the DNA. So there's a whole other category and class, if you will, of mechanisms of action of the other peptides, whereas these ones are very specific to DNA. Mm-hmm. And they're really tiny. The interesting thing about these also is that without fail, they are modulatory. So that means that they will never push you into overdrive. They will never suppress function. They only seek their gig, their role, if you will, is to get the body to homeostasis, to balance. So for example, like the best example of this is there's a bioregulator for the thyroid gland. You can administer this bioregulator to someone who's either hyperthyroid or hypothyroid. In either case, what it'll look to do is to normalize thyroid function. So, you know, there's not a whole lot of compounds in the world that you can just throw at the body and the body's going to know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Or it's not going to, you don't have a risk of, oh, it could go too far one way or the other. I mean, BPC-157 has a bit of those properties. Like BPC-157 in certain studies on animals was shown to normalize blood pressure. So again, bring it back to where it needs to be. But the bioregulators, without fail, seek to restore homeostasis. So you're never going to become a superhuman necessarily using a bioregulator, but you are always what you're going to try and do is mitigate the wear and tear on your body as you age so that you just keep bringing it back up.
You're going to mitigate the side effects from all the other more crazy stuff you're doing to become superhuman.
Hopefully. We hope. But, you know, so lots of other interesting little tidbits of information about bioregulators is where do they come from, right? So we can take bioregulators orally. The oral bioregulators are sourced from animals, and they're sourced from those tissues, glands, and organs in the animals that they will target in you. So if we want to, target the pineal gland, right, which is that little pine nut shaped gland in your brain that regulates your circadian cycle, it regulates melatonin production, it happens to be the master endocrine regulator in the body, and also it helps to restore telomere length, some really kind of cool effects there, right? That's going to come from pineal glands of cows. Right. So where I was going with that is that, you know, when we look at the carnivore community and in some of the cases, some of the really transformative benefits that people have seen, usually it's people who are eating true nose to tail, or they're consuming the supplements of desiccated organs. And right. And this is old medicine.
Right. And, you know, this idea has been around for a long time. And I think largely in the naturopathic tradition, there's this idea of using glands, using adrenal gland or thymus gland or specific glandular tissues from cows or pigs with the idea that it helps heal those glands in us. And I have always been very skeptical of this claim because it didn't, there was no apparent plausible mechanism by which that could be true. Under the assumption that all of those compounds will be digested and broken down to amino acids. But what we now know is that not all the proteins that we consume are broken down into, you know, individual amino acids. In many cases, they're broken down into short peptide fragments. And what we now know is that many of these short peptide fragments are physiologically active in that unique peptide configuration. So now correct. There's a plausible mechanism for how that could be true.
Yeah, exactly. And it's being proven, right? So the bioregulator supplement, if you will, takes it one step further. So they've now purified and concentrated it. So it's a little bit like you're going to get vitamin C from an orange, but you're going to get a lot more vitamin C in a capsule. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. And just to be clear, going back to the carnivore thing, there's no plausible mechanism by which consuming broccoli might negate the effect of some of those peptides, is there?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'm gonna say no.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I think carnivore is a great intervention, personally. It can be for some people, but it's not necessarily. I'm not fully in on the all carnivore all the time is optimal, but you know.
Well, I'm much more critical of it than you. and that was very charitable though. And I do think that it's possible that people can notice short-term benefits from it, where they often conclude that it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, usually before they notice the longer term harms of it.
I'm kind of with you. I just think that there are some interesting case studies out there of people who've made it work for them for quite a long time. Sure. And you know, we both probably know who they are, but I also think there's bioindividuality at play here. Who knows what it is about those people, their genetics, and that it just works for them, but it's definitely not, I don't buy it as a panacea for the whole world personally.
Yeah, I mean,
but I love mistake.
I think for me, no more than I see people who have been on a long-term potato only diet as, you know, and improve, lost weight and improve their metabolic health as evidence that eating only potatoes is the best human diet. I mean, there's so lots of examples of extreme diets that one could have, and you could cite anecdotes of great improvements in metabolic health. And I think we have to be wary of then concluding that each one of those diets, of raw vegan diets to potato only diets to meat only diets, is the best way to eat, you know?
So yeah, no, I'm with you. So there's no argument there.
All right. So we'll get back to peptides. So
let's get back to peptides.
So on the topic of bioregulators, what are some of the most compelling studies you've seen or evidence on specific bioregulators in terms of the effects that they've had?
So some of the most compelling studies have come out, certainly come out of Russia, right? So there are a couple of studies that many interesting things about Dr. Kavinson or Professor Kavinson is that when the Russian military approached him to develop this whole area, if you will, of medicine or regenerative medicine, if you will, it was really born out of the fact that they had their submarine operators and military guys coming back from places and cosmonauts, they were aged, they were falling apart, right? They'd sustained a lot of damage from what they were being exposed to, being radiation and that kind of stuff. And so they kind of came to him, this young promising doctor in the military, and said, hey, you have like carte blanche, you have as much money as you want, and if you need subjects to do experiments on, we've got like factories full of people who are living miserable lives. You can test stuff out on them within reason, I'm sure. So when Kavinson went about doing his work, and he did his first work on animals, and he did a lot of computer modeling and all the stuff that he did, when it came time to practice on people, he had access to large communities of people that he could run. He could basically say, you guys, they were double blind studies, and half the people were getting bioregulators and the other half of the people were getting vitamins. And without fail, the people getting the bioregulators always did better than the people getting vitamins. And there's a couple of very slightly smaller studies. There's one he did on, I think it was 266 elderly people. And by elderly, we were talking, I think they were 65 to 75 year olds. And all he did is he gave them Apitalon. And the cool thing is this was an 8-year study. And all they did, nobody changed their lifestyle. Nobody changed anything about what they were doing. They were just taking these vitamins. And they took the vitamins, I believe it was either I think it was only 2 years, maybe three.
Taking these vitamins, do you mean?
So half the people were taking, half were taking vitamins and the other half were taking bioregulators.
Okay,
And he was able to show that at the end of 8 years, the bioregulator crew had, I think it was 30% less all-cause mortality than the other guys. They had better immunity, their immune system was better. So first of all, it upgraded their immune system, right? So Apitalon is, and they were getting, the only thing they were getting was Apitalon. When he added thymolin to it, which is the thymus bioregulator, things got even better. Mm-hmm. Then he went and he took that was the 12-year study. Sorry, because then when he did the 75 to 85-year-old study, that's when he was only 6 years, because of course nobody expected them to live that long anyway. Mm-hmm. And again, the number of all-cause mortality was a fraction in the group that got the bioregulators versus the group that got the vitamins. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they slept better, they had better bone density, they had better quality of life, their immune function was far and above better. Is it because they had longer telomeres? Unlikely. Like, because, you know, I think, you know, as well as I do, like the relationship between telomeres and longevity hasn't fully been elucidated. Like, obviously having super short telomeres is not a good strategy, but having long telomeres isn't a guarantee either. So there's something there. We haven't pinned it down yet. Right. So those two studies were incredibly important. Some of the other studies he did some rat studies where they took, and again, you know, like you need, I'm not a big I don't have a research lab, but apparently research rats are super expensive. And he did some studies on rats. He had male rats and female rats, exposed them to 24/7 light. And these are rats that are prone to develop tumors. And in the rats getting the Apitalon, the male rats would develop, I think it was leukemia, whereas the female rats would develop mammary tumors. And in both cases, the rats getting the Apitalon did way better. They had lower mortality and or they had smaller or fewer tumors. Mm-hmm. So there, if you go on PubMed, it's like anything else. You just have to know the question to ask, because the studies, a lot of the studies are there. Mm-hmm. And he's actually still publishing work and still to this day identifying new bioregulator peptides. So Jean-François, our mutual friend, was telling me the other day that he recently published a paper, and one of the fragments of thymus and beta 4, which is one of those peptides over there, he's identified, he believes, is a bioregulator peptide. And it's interesting that thymus and beta 4, there's another study that came out a while ago that showed that it can restore the stemness of cardiac cells. So it can help to rejuvenate the heart muscle.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Okay. Have you personally experimented with bioregulators? And if so, what are some of the ones that you noticed the biggest effects from, or the most noticeable effects?
That's a good question. So I will tell you that I'm part of a clinical trial where I'm using anywhere from 8 to 9 bioregulators a month. Like, I'm cycling through these things all the time, mm-hmm. right? One of the big differences between bioregulators and peptides is very often when you're using a peptide, it's for, I'm trying to fix this. I have a sore back. I pulled a muscle. I've got an injury I'm trying to fix. So when we use the peptide, we experience the benefit usually within a month, sometimes within days. With the bioregulators, it tends to be much more subtle. So I can't tell you that when I'm taking, the kidney bioregulator, oh, my kidneys feel so much better, or the liver bioregulator. But where we see it sometimes is in people who really have an imbalance that they're trying to fix. And this is where the Facebook community that you just recently joined is a bit of a gift to me, right? Because it is like a living lab. Mm-hmm. We have over 12,000 people, many of whom are using different bioregulators. And every once in a while, you hear from people like, as a matter of fact, one of the people on my team is a young woman who'd not had a cycle in almost a year. And she was, she was doing all kinds of different things. She was working with a practitioner to kind of figure it out. They were kind of stuck. She started taking Apitalon, and then she added the ovarian bioregulator. Within a month, her cycle came back.
Wow.
Now, it doesn't, now, before everybody runs out stampedes to the store, just to be clear.
I'm going to be the one stampeding to the store to get my cycle back.
I can see it in your eyes. I can see it in your eyes. You're like, oh my God, I can get my cycle back. So it's, if you read the literature also, so in her case, it was what was needed. It was like the final piece that was needed to move the needle. I've had women in the group also with overactive bladder who will use the bladder bioregulator, and they find that things start to improve, right? So there's different ways of using bioregulators. One way of using bioregulators is kind of as a stopgap, right? So you're just using it a couple times a year, 2 or 3 times a year, you'll do a cycle just to kind of make up for those deficiencies that build up over time naturally. Mm-hmm. Or bioregulators can also be used in a more therapeutic sense. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, they're used with more intention. They're used for a longer period of time. They're used in different types of cycles, but they're also combined with all of the other things you're going to bring to bear to restore balance to that area. Mm-hmm. So if I'm working on thyroid, I'm going to make sure that my diet is not destroying my thyroid. I'm going to make sure that I've got enough iodine in my system, that I'm not exposed to chlorine and fluoride and all the other things that are going to displace the iodine. I'm going to make sure I'm not deficient in selenium. I'm going to check on those thyroid antibodies. Like, the bioregulators are amazing, but you still have to do all the work around them to make it happen.
Of course. Right? Yeah.
So there's a couple of immune bioregulators that they talk about will help to restore the health to the immune system after cancer therapies, for example. Mm. Right? Because now what we know, the cancer, the radiation or what have you, has taken a huge toll on your system. So if we can have access to these bioregulators that can help to like restore that function, can we maybe help to improve people's long-term outlook? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so there's several categories or types of these bioregulators. We have, as you kind of mentioned briefly there, there's some for the thyroid, there's pineal gland bioregulators, there's kidney, I think liver, and
there's heart,
a number of others. Yeah,
heart, blood vessel, thymus, liver, pancreas, kidney, testes, prostate, ovaries, adrenals, bone marrow, muscle, cartilage. Cartilage is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Cartilage is one of my favorites, only because when I read about this, I was like, oh, of course. So cartilage upregulates the production of collagen and elastin. So, you know, we think of cartilage, oh, okay, it's going to be good for my joints. Well, it's also really good for my skin, but it's also really important for my heart and my kidneys and all the other organs that have to have flex because they also rely on collagen and elastin. Mm-hmm. So it's just when you start to dig into them a little bit, it's just really interesting how, although they're very specific, they have wide ranging effects in the body. So Apitalon, which we think of for the pineal gland, there's actually receptors for the Apitalon also in the thymus gland.
Interesting.
Right. So it's really kind of cool that it's very specific to that pineal gland, but it has a real effect on immunity as well.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay. So given that there's whatever, 15 or
20, yeah, there's over 20. Yeah.
Of these different compounds, and it can be expensive to use, let's say all of them. Let's say if somebody was inclined to use all of them, let's say every month, this might,
but you're not going to use all 21 every month, but yeah.
I mean, there's probably some people out there, and I might be in this personality type too, who wants to do everything possible.
Bring
to
it. Yeah. How
would one sort of go about figuring out how to do a routine, which ones to choose, and how often to use them?
Yeah. So, I mean, the bad news is there's no manual of how to establish bioregulator protocols. I would say that the researcher who's running the clinical trial that I'm involved in is probably as close to that as anybody. And right now he's not sharing. Right. So having said that,
so we're all shit out of luck, huh?
Well, we're not. I mean, I've been working with the bioregulators for a while, like for a couple of years now, and I've started to kind of figure out, run protocols for people. Where I kind of shy away is, you know, when in someone who has a real disease or, you know, like real imbalances going on, I'm not going to say, oh yeah, we can fix that with bioregulators. Have no fear. But when it comes to thinking about restoring function in the body, what my approach is to look at, you know, where are your kind of weakness, your strengths and weaknesses, if you will. And so we may lean into certain areas more than others, but generally speaking, over the course of 12 months, you might cycle through most of the bioregulators, and some of them you're going to use for 3 or 4 months over that 12 months, and others you might use for 6 or 8 months. Like, let's say you did your biological age test and you found out your telomere length is not really where it needs to be for your age group, right? So this is in a world where we're looking at our chronological to our biological age. And if we're tracking ahead, you know, this is the race you don't want to be winning. Mm-hmm. You want to be the slow, you want to be the tortoise here. You do not want to be the rabbit. Mm-hmm. So if you're at an accelerated aging, we want to slow that down. We want to restore telomere length. Well, we know we're going to be using Apitalon a whole bunch of times through the year. We're going to lean into that, right? If let's say somebody's got, you know, issues with their bladder, well, we might repeat that bladder bioregulator more often than we might for someone who's never had an issue with their bladder. Mm-hmm. we're not going to expect that someone who's taking thyroid medication is miraculously going to come off that thyroid medication. Sometimes, in some cases, if the timing is right, if there's enough health left in the gland, when maybe you might see someone who, and they're doing everything else right, you might see someone who suddenly is able to reduce their medication. But we don't know going in that that's going to be an outcome that we can expect, at least not with the insight that we have right now.
Are there rough guidelines about how many one should use at once, or what would be considered overkill?
Yeah, I think, I mean, what I've seen, certainly what I've seen in the work that I've seen is usually like three or four at a time. Mm-hmm. And so what the way that it generally works is you would do, the way I like to do it with people is I like to start people with a almost like an induction period. So a 30-day run, especially when we're working on a system that needs a little bit more support, we might start with a 30-day run. But a typical cycle of a bioregulator when we're talking maintenance, or even if we're talking therapeutic, but we're doing it over time, is we're going 10 days a month. And the logic behind that, if you think about it, makes sense. The body responds really well to pulses. Mm-hmm. Right? It does that in so many ways. Like there's so many reasons why you don't want to chronically be pushing on that receptor over and over and over again. So it's a 10 day on, 20 day off, 10 day on. So what we might do is we might cycle, like for me, if I'm using 9 bioregulators in a month, I'll be doing 3 for the first 10 days, 3 for the next 10 days, and 3 for the 10 days after that.
Okay. Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is if it's better to use all of them during one specific 10 days and take 20 days off from everything, or.
Yeah, no, think about it this way. You're giving the stimulus to different parts of the body to do the work at different times.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And like for something with Apitalon, another, you asked earlier about seeing results. Apitalon can be used really effectively sometimes for people with disrupted circadian cycles, or mm-hmm. even for insomnia. There's some studies that show, but you know, I don't know how many other things they're throwing at people, but we know, you and I both know, that if somebody's taking Apitalon hoping to fix their circadian cycle and they're staying up at night and they're sleeping in the morning and they're not exposing themselves to natural light and they're not eating, stopping their food at the right time and starting to eat at the right time, like you have to lean into it, right? Mm-hmm. You have to do all the things.
Yeah, of course.
And so that this thing can now flip the switch.
Right. Okay. So what about, there's another compound that I know you're a big fan of that I think that there's some debate over whether it's in the bioregulator category or not, and that is GHK. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So GHK is a great peptide. I'm hoping that I get to meet Dr. Kevinson at the end of September. I'm going to be at a conference that he's speaking at. So you and I both know I'll be whatever it takes. I'll put like a tablecloth over my head and sidle up to him when he's not watching and say, hey, like whatever I need to do. So I don't know what his criteria are for what is a bioregulator and what is not, because on paper, GHK sure looks like a bioregulator. It's only 3 amino acids.
And right? It affects DNA.
And it affects DNA. But the thing with GHK is it affects like 1,000 genes. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's like busy, busy bee running up and down the DNA, flipping genes on and off. Like it's a bit nutty. It's like the, what's the word I'm looking for? The overachiever, right? It's like, it doesn't stop at 4 or 5 genes. It's like, ooh, look at all these things. I can flip all these switches.
So whereas, basically what you're saying is like, look, GHK, you do a little bit too much as far as turning on too many genes. So we don't know if we're going to call you a bioregulator or
not. Well, no, I don't know. Like what I'm saying is I don't know what Professor Kevinson's criteria is.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's not a bioregulator because he didn't discover it, or if it's not a bioregulator.
Like, right. This is one of the few that he didn't discover. It was what some guy named Lauren something. Lauren Picard.
Yeah, in 1973, who's got a really cool site called reverseskinaging.com, because of course GHK's what it's best known for is for skin. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is that GHKCU, right? So it's GHK and it needs copper to be activated. is incredible for wound healing. It has immune benefits. It's got like, it's every time I find something on GHK and I read about it, I'm like, it does that too. Oh my God, it does that. Like it is kind of like, I mean, it's unknown still. It needs to be studied and studied and studied some more.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Are there any other compounds, peptides that you think we didn't cover adequately that are worth mentioning here?
Yeah, sure, tons. But, you know, I think
I mean that in the bioregulator category.
Yeah, I think in the bioregulator world, if you had to pick one, you would pick, I mean, if I had to pick one, I would pick Apitalon, hands down every time, right? It's anti-tumorigenic, which I probably didn't say earlier. It's a master endocrine regulator. It normalizes your melatonin production, so you're going to sleep better, you're going to recover faster. And melatonin, we know, is much more than a sleep hormone. It's like, it's got 1,000 different uses that we still don't know, right? So that would be the one. But when we look at the literature, there are three bioregulators that are really at the center of almost any protocol. And that would be Apitalon being the pineal bioregulator, the thymus bioregulator, because thymus being the seat of your immune system, really, other than the gut, but that's different. And then the blood vessel bioregulator, right? So the blood vessel bioregulator, if you can restore function and flexibility and integrity to your blood vessels, both on a macro and a micro level, that means you're able to bring nutrients to and remove waste products at a cellular level. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to get better from that, right?
So those three you would use sort of as a base stack, regardless of somebody's specific needs or priorities, and you would use those maybe the most times per year.
Probably, you know, like I just make sure. And then when I think about it, you know, so somebody comes and let's say they're being treated for cardiovascular issues, right? Their heart's not the best, or they have blood pressure issues, whatever the case may be. So I'm sitting there going, I'm thinking of the system and I'm like, well, you know, the blood vessels are going to be really important here. The heart's going to be really important and the kidneys are going to be important. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, we start to think in systems a little bit. The other thing I think that would be good for your audience to know on the bioregulator front is there's different methods of administration. So we have the oral bioregulator, which we can get in capsule form, which are actual extracts from those tissues, glands, and organs. So vegans need not apply because yes, it came from an animal, putting it out there. The advantage of the oral bioregulator is that there are probably other cofactors in addition to those bioregulator peptides in those capsules. And so typically we talk about the oral bioregulator taking longer to act, but having a longer runway of action. Like it lasts longer. Mm-hmm. There are then the synthetic bioregulators. So this is in the case where scientists have identified and isolated that 2 to 4 amino acid chain, and it can now be recreated in a lab. And those could be administered either by subcutaneous injection, or increasingly we're seeing them being produced as sublingual sprays. And some people are even using them as intranasal, but I'm more skeptical on that front.
Do you have a preference on oral versus sublingual?
Oral versus synthetic. So
are all the sublinguals synthetic, or are some of
they're
them?
They're always synthetic.
Okay.
Right. So the oral is always going to be kind of like the extract, and the synthetic is always. So one thing that I learned this summer is that in Russia, at the Institute of Gerontology and Bioregulation, they will use the synthetic bioregulator first in people who have a lot of autoimmune issues. Mm. And that's because there's just less for them to react to, mm-hmm. and they're faster acting. So you're going to get a faster pickup. You're going to get a faster impact, if you will. And then they'll finish them off. Then they'll, after they've done their first couple of months with the synthetic, they will then move over to the biologic.
Got it.
So there's just different ways of using them.
Okay. My last question to you is about questions. It is about your least favorite question. I've seen it asked a number of times in your Facebook group, and I know you hate getting asked this question.
Yeah.
And it is there a peptide for blank?
Is there a peptide for what?
Is there a peptide for blank issue? So why is this your least favorite question?
It's my pet peeve question. It's like my desert island peptides and my pet peeve question. Because if you don't know what's driving the issue, we don't know what the peptide is, what peptide you need for it, mm-hmm. right? So think about it. Your issue 99% of the time is a symptom. It's an expression of a problem. It's an expression of a damage, of a pathway that's not working properly, or an injury that's being done to the body. And so if we don't know where it's coming from, it's hard to know what peptide can help. Mm-hmm. The possible exception to that rule is there a peptide for leaky gut, for healing the gut? Mm-hmm. And yeah, BPC-157, it's you know, it gets special dispensation in so many ways, that peptide. And it's one of those peptides that sometimes can help people to feel better before they've even started to do what needs to be done to finish mm-hmm. the job. Mm-hmm. But there aren't a lot of peptides like that, and it's not always the case. But of course, you know as well as I do, you're going to get better results if you stop drinking alcohol and eating crappy food and eating, sitting at your desk, inhaling without chewing, super stressed, and, you know, doing all the crazy things that are driving the problem in the first place. Mm-hmm. Stop doing those. Use the BPC, add in some glutamine, some zinc, maybe some tributyrate, like throw in some stuff that's going to help to heal. And all of a sudden, guess what? The magic is really going to happen, and it's going to happen fast.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, last is just, where can people find you and learn mm-hmm. more about the work you're doing? And are there any resources or places you want to direct people towards?
Thank you for that. So there's the Facebook group, which I'm on the cusp of pulling the trigger on. I'm not going to move it off Facebook, because I learned the hard way a year ago that you can't move thousands of people anywhere unless they want to be moved. Mm-hmm. But I am going to be launching a community on a different platform soon. It's going to cost a little bit of money, but we're not going to get censored, and we're not going to live under this cloud of possibility that our host one day is not going to be happy with what we're saying and just shut us down.
Yeah.
Until that day, Optimizing Superhuman Performance is the name of the group on Facebook. So if you join that group, I'm in there quite a lot, and it is a remarkable community. It's very, very active. There's the Biohacking Superhuman Performance podcast, which, you know,
I've listened to a number of episodes of, and I enjoy.
I'm going to have you on sometime. We're going to have to.
I would love to. Podcast. Yeah, I will say there's not many health podcasts that I can listen, that I do listen to. And yours is one of the ones that I do listen to. You have always very unique guests on, and I enjoy your commentary and the questions that you ask, the insights that you bring to it as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And then Instagram. I mean, look, guys, don't waste your time on Instagram. I mean, you know, I publish stuff for the podcast on Instagram. I can't live my life on Instagram. I try every once in a while. I throw up a video or something, but it's, you know, I just can't do it.
All right. So follow the podcast. I'm with you, by the way. I spend very little time on social media. So follow the podcast. And yeah. Is the best place to do that on iTunes or YouTube?
Yeah,
or
Spotify, anything. It's also on YouTube if you're a more visual person. So it's the Biohacking Superhuman Performance podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think I left out a couple of letters of the alphabet there. I tried to get them all. And then the Facebook community is Optimizing Superhuman Performance. And, you know, in the next little while, there'll be either a course or something coming out. I need to sit down long enough to actually do it.
I know you were working on, I think I remember in one podcast you did recently where you said you were working on some kind of cheat sheet for peptides or something like that.
Yeah,
is that still in the works? You're still going through the volumes, encyclopedic volumes of works on peptides to compile?
Yeah. So I think I'm going to do it for bioregulators, honestly. I think I'm going to start with bioregulators, and because there's lots of stuff out there on peptides, although I'm sure I could do one too. What's happened is I've recently gotten a virtual assistant, and so we're just getting up to speed with each other. Like, I'm not going to lie. I need to be trained as much as he does on helping. I need to help to be trained to help him to help me, kind of thing. but he's got some graphic design abilities. So I think I'll try and pull something together in the next little while. So when you sign up for my newsletter on my website, you'll be able to get the bioregulator cheat sheet. And that website is natnidham.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Natalie. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Me too. Likewise. Thank you so much, Ari. This has been great.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family, help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.